Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. There's a big difference between a solution that measures a fundraiser's performance and a solution that helps a fundraiser perform. QBAC helps fundraisers to excel at their most critical task, developing deep, meaningful relationships with donors and cultivating them into lifelong givers. Give your fundraisers a better qualified portfolio, one that considers more than just capacity and simple scoring. Your fundraisers will also get insights into the hearts, minds, and connections of their donors. Fundraisers have a tough job. Help them close bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Podcast listeners, the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow is finally back on the schedule. We have several dates confirmed. Since 2014, our team has been providing high-quality one-day roadshows in partnership with nonprofit leaders who want to showcase their space and provide thought-provoking and highly interactive fundraising training in their nonprofit community. Our roadshows have been described by our guest as hands down the best professional development experience that they have ever been a part of. This experience has been described as challenging assumptions with conversation-inspiring content and new ways of thinking. If you would like to register for one of the upcoming stops on the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow, just visit the link in the show notes. Hi, Alex. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I have, we've just figured out, we sort of compared notes and figured out where we had met in the past. And so I'm delighted to sort of reconvene our conversation. It's you and I share some common threads here in the state of Pennsylvania that may come up. One of the things I recently shared with a previous guest from the Lehigh Valley is that my children were actually both born in the, two of my four children were born at the St. Luke's Hospital. So we know the Lehigh Valley pretty well. Before we dive into our conversation today, Alex, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure thing, Jason. And I was born at St. Luke's, and my son was also born at St. Luke's.
No kidding.
Lots of connections there in the Lehigh Valley. But thank you, Jason. It's a pleasure to be in your company this afternoon. Feel like long time listener, first time caller here because I've been following your stuff on LinkedIn and the podcast. So thank you for having me. As you mentioned, I'm Alex Dabkowitz. I live here in the Lehigh Valley region, Eastern Pennsylvania. I'm a donor relations director. That's a major gift officer with the Salvation Army in Eastern Pennsylvania and Delaware. So I primarily work out of the Philadelphia area, spend a good amount of time in this part of the state. A little bit about me. I've been in fundraising in one form or another pretty much my entire career, which has not been particularly long, about a decade or so. Minus a couple years I spent as a freelance writer, a swim coach, and a couple other odd jobs before I accidentally stumbled my way into a development associate role with the Human Services Organization back in 2011. I've worked in a few different capacities and a couple smaller shops. I'd say the Salvation Army is one of the bigger ones I've worked in. I've worked across, marketing communications, some little bits of web design, grant writing, foundation, corporate relations, pretty much over the past 5 years have focused, pretty much exclusively on major gift work and, a little bit of corporate relations work here and there. So it's a great career path and, excited to be here today.
Yeah. I haven't talked to, Alex, I haven't talked to anybody in the Salvation Army in a long time. We've had a couple of Salvationists on the podcast, but it's probably been a couple hundred episodes, I've got to say. And I certainly haven't talked to anybody from the Salvation Army since how we all navigated the pandemic. What is the story there at the Salvation Army as it relates to the pandemic? I mean, is there any sort of, enlightening sort of
realities that you guys sort of came to or anything like that in great stories?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was crazy. I started at the Salvation Army in the middle of the pandemic. So I got thrown right in at year end, which is the craziest fundraising time for the Salvation Army. Outside of the red kettles, you usually see it, you know, Walmart and Macy's and those sorts of places, you know, local supermarkets. You know, the interesting thing starting at the Salvation Army, you saw, you know, a major uptick in generosity towards, you know, what we do at our core community centers, though. You have one in York, we have one in Allentown, in a lot of other cities. We manage a lot of other programs, but obviously, you know, the needs for, you know, there's food insecurity, you know, folks struggling with homelessness. I mean, that's always something we're dealing with. But I think the pandemic, you know, really shone a light on, you know, kind of how fragile everything was. And I know that our divisional commander had made a comment to the effect of, you know, when he was looking out at, you know, the food lines, they would get longer and longer, but the cars were starting over time over the first 4 to 6 weeks in that March, you know, April 2020, the cars were starting to get nicer, you know. So I think the Salvation Army has always stood behind the fact that, you know, a lot of the folks that come to us never thought they would be in a position where they need assistance. And, you know, we offer, you know, that assistance, that help, whether it be, you know, through feeding, through, you know, a night of shelter. We offer, you know, things like, you know, emergency rental assistance or help paying a utility bill too. And that's all done, you know, kind of at the local, at the core level. So the folks that came to us, I think initially, you know, plenty of people that have used our services before, but others that thought they would never have to, you know, stand and, you know, and ask for help. And, you know, we're thrilled, we're grateful to have the capacity to be able to do that for those who need it.
Yeah, Alex, that makes me, that reminds me of an experience. I remember being right in the thick of the pandemic. This was probably late summer of 2020. And I remember my wife and I and our children were in a local shopping center that neighbors the local food bank. The food bank had recently purchased an old Kmart, you know, old Kmart and turned it into one of their primary distribution centers here in York. And I remember the number of cars there. I remember sort of snapping a photograph and posting it on, you know, on Facebook probably or something. And so just sort of reflecting on the number of people that were in line. And I can probably, as I'm thinking about it now, I'm sort of recalling the same sort of observation that the mix of cars, for example, was very different. But honestly, it was the volume, right? It was the number of people that were sort of coming out.
Yes. Yeah.
In response for need. So, yeah, that's pretty extraordinary. Alex, you know this. You've listened to the podcast for quite some time. You're a familiar listener, and I appreciate that. We always invite our guests to come on here with a big idea or bold opinion. I don't usually know. I don't know where you're going to take us today. Usually, that makes for a fun conversation. You said before we hit the record button that it may not be the you know. Whether it measures up, I don't know. We'll push it up. We'll push it up, brother. What do you got for us today?
All right. Well, yeah, I think, and I said that jokingly because, you know, what I planned to talk about, Jason, was something that I think I was on LinkedIn a little earlier and saw an article in the Chronicle of Philanthropy published, you know, about this, not exactly the same topic. So, I think this conversation to me is a little bit timely based on what was published in the Chronicle, which was about, you know, job dissatisfaction, understaffing, turnover amongst fundraising professionals. And I feel like, you know, in our field, you know, the Chronicle or somebody like it is publishing the same article every, you know, once every year and has been maybe, you know, since like I was born in the 80s. But, you know, what I wanted to talk about a little bit, I think, is the job search process itself for fundraising. And I'm using this from my own personal experience, you know, of how kind of bizarre and challenging it could be. You know, and I think you recommended a book to me called Consumed by Benjamin Barber, which is a great read. I've gotten far enough in it, but Benjamin Barber makes this point about how, you know, kind of the consumer economy, you know, infantilizes adults to some degree. And I think there's nothing that I've seen like over my time. And I graduated in the middle of the Great Recession, 2008-2009, where it was brutally challenging to find a job. And I've seen nothing that really to me infantilizes adults, like kind of more than the job search process to some degree. You know, and I think at the time when I graduated, you know, adults were kind of being like taught, or you're reading content on LinkedIn that's kind of teaching you to beg for approval and jump through hoops for, you know, the ludicrous number of interviews and skills tests and time consuming assignments, like being asked to write an entire fundraising plan, you know, that you're just going to hand over to a nonprofit in the hopes that they'll hire you. So, you know, since the Great Recession, and that's, you know, 10, 15 years ago at this point, and, you know, the time during which I graduated from college, you know, I really don't feel that the process for candidates, especially in, you know, nonprofits or fundraising, has improved a lot. I really contend that there needs to be kind of a wake-up call to hiring managers on how to best recruit and retain fundraising talent, as a Chronicle probably talked about it a little bit. Yeah, but simultaneously, I think candidates also need to really keep their eyes open, as I kind of have started to, as I spent, you know, how many years interviewing in the nonprofit space, you know, to keep their eyes open to red flags and warning signs of, you know, maybe not dysfunctional cultures, or just cultures where you're not going to be allowed to thrive and do what you like. You know, and I tie this, I know I'm rambling here, but, you know, I just want to say, I tie this back into Benjamin Barber's thesis again. You know, as a candidate, you know, look out for if your interviewer is talking about fundraising, you know, how are they talking about it as a relationship business, or are they using, you know, strictly consumerist language, for instance? As you would say, probably, I know you're three lanes and everything like that. You have to pay attention, I think, as a candidate for an interview where the obsession keeps coming back to shallow, sort of those lane one fundraising tactics. And simultaneously, I'd say, you know, EDs and board members, you know, and I use this, you know, a lot in small shops, you know, they need to understand if they're having trouble finding or retaining talent, you know, in a lot of cases, they need to really only look in the mirror.
You know, I think back on that, probably that event that you and I met at, and I'm reflecting on some of the argument that I made in that first book, and I'm reflecting on your thoughts about sort of where this all has sort of come to today. And I saw that same article that you're referring to. I think we're referring to the same article that just came out. Yes. And they tend to sort of rehash the same story and the same sort of, they sort of study the same sort of pattern of behavior that seems to get told every couple of years, at least. And I kind of wonder is there a more discerning, one of the things that I've talked a lot about here on the podcast and elsewhere is the fundraiser becoming more discerning about where they're landing in place, whether or not they're landing in places that can actually set them up for success? Because I think that's, and I think back on even some of my conversations in particular during the pandemic, and I just wonder if part of the challenge that happens with all this turnover, and, you know, in your sort of, you're referencing Barber's work, the idea of sort of, do we all need to do a little growing up? I think the fundraising professional as a whole needs to do a lot of growing up. And some of that growing up is in my mind about the idea of knowing that, Alex, when you interview, like you're suggesting, some of the questions that are asked of you in that interview process, do these people even know what they're talking about? Does this board or boss even know? Do you follow what I'm saying? You see the, I know where you're going. I think we're going in the same direction.
Yeah, no, I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's challenging because when I graduated during the recession, I mean, I interviewed quite a bit. It was not easy to find a job. And at that point I was probably, you know, interviewing more and, you know, for profit. I was looking to get into more of, you know, Marcom, you know, sort of role where I could do a lot of writing, honestly. And, you know, I obviously stumbled my way into sort of a different career path. But, you know, things I didn't know in, say, 2011 when I interviewed for, you know, my first, you know, fundraising job, quote unquote. You know, it's interesting is like you get farther along in, you know, where I was looking to perhaps change jobs in the past or something, you know, and, you know, I have a couple examples that always stood out to me that were really like kind of bizarre. And, you know, one was that when I was more working as a grant writer, and I was interviewing at a local college for a grant writing role, and sat down at the interview table, and, you know, and the two interviewers just had, you know, a list of questions, and they didn't look up at me for the entire time. And not only that, before I was even allowed to interview, they're like, yeah, we need to go ahead and you're going to need to, you know, go ahead and do this like 30-minute exercise in Microsoft Word so we can like really see that you know how to use Word. And I'm like, yeah, well, how did you think, what was I writing grants on then? I mean, like, so between that and another interview where it was the same kind of situation for actually like an advancement manager, which was, you know, sort of at least a mid-level or a major gifts role, you know, get through the whole interview, and I put my salary requirements in the application. They're like, yeah, actually the salary we're looking at is about, you know, $10,000 to $15,000 less. Like, would you be cool with that? That's so, you know, and it's kind of odd to be like, you know, to be asked and kind of treated like rudely like that. And I think you're right. You know, I think folks now, you know, I was a political science major, so I didn't come out of college knowing what fundraising was or have any idea what it was really. And I think you're probably right. Maybe as younger generations are getting into it, you know, for instance, a couple a couple of younger folks I work with in the office, you know, they went to school, they went to school with the intention of ending up at least in a nonprofit sort of sector. That was the goal, you know, working in a fundraising shop. So they're going to be more discerning, I hope. You know, my goal is to, you know, my goal would be to teach people who are looking at career, you know, if they listen, it would be like, look for these warning signs where somebody treats you poorly in an interview and understand that, you know, that's the best you're ever going to get treated in that job. And just because the mission's great, that's not going to make you, most nonprofits have great missions, it's not going to make you happy.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I think more of us are sort of waking up to, again, and I don't know if this has to do with, I don't know if this is sort of a pre-pandemic sort of reality or if this is something that sort of happened as a result of the pandemic, but there's a what I oftentimes refer to as sort of this qualitative turn. So I think we're seeing that if we're going to sign on for these jobs, are we going to sign on for jobs that are heavily metric focused or that, you know, it's all about the quantifiable dollars in, dollar, you know, dollars raised. Or are we actually interviewing for jobs where there's a commitment to a qualitative sort of experience for both the donor, but, you know, and also for the fundraiser? I think so often fundraisers are signing on for jobs where, you know, I said this to my students recently, you know, you can be perceived in a lot of settings like a tool. And I think too often fundraisers are signing on for jobs with employers where we're just sort of a mechanism. We're just a tool. We're just a sort of a, you know, a bolted on sort of machine. And we're not there to experience something meaningful. And therefore, we can't create that meaningful experience for our donors. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I love what you're saying, but it's kind of funny because I feel like the language like that you're using is it starts in the job descriptions themselves, and even at bigger shops, like even at bigger shops, like you go to look at like, you know, a liberal arts college, like there's never I gripe about this where the occasional times I post on LinkedIn, this is the biggest these are kind of the biggest topics I gripe about. I know it's a nitpicky thing, but I mean, how many JDs, Jason, have you read where, you know, all you see about major gifts? Will carry a portfolio of 125 donors. Will be expected to make 80 to 100 visits per year. Must submit 2 proposals each month. Must have experience closing many 5, 6, and 7-figure gifts. Like, again, where's the joy in, like, if you're trying to attract talent? I mean, start there. I mean, I read a great JD for a major gift fundraiser, I think, at a college in Erie, PA the other day. And it was like a 1-paragraph thing. And it pretty much said, you're going to carry this portfolio. And here are like 3 or 4 key skill sets that we think would be really helpful in this role. We hope you apply. So almost you could be looking backward to like the 1970s, like advertisements in a newspaper where, you know, it was 1 paragraph and just said like, you know, here's what you're doing, apply within, instead of, as you said, I mean, it's kind of deadening to know that everything you, all the, you know, it's just the one size fits all kind of KPI language is sort of, I think if employers started there to begin with and, you know, worked through their interview process to like actually make it a pleasant experience and to think a little more deeply about, we're trying to hire somebody who understands major gifts or wants to work in major gifts. Like, why do we keep coming back to talking about the golf tournament or the newsletter and those sorts of things? So I'm on two different points there, but
you're really not. And you know, that's one of the reasons our consultancy uses the 3 lanes, for example. I think there's some of the conversations that we're consistently having. A lot of my guests, whether they were familiar with the 3 lanes that we use at our consultancy or not, they're starting to sort of wake up to the idea that lane one fundraising is oftentimes better outsourced, meaning it doesn't need to be a job description because there's somebody that you can, you know, you can contract out direct response. You can contract out your special event planning. You can contract out so many of these things. And so like one of the simple rules that we've embedded in our 3 lanes is that the first fundraiser on the payroll, whoever that individual might be, starts in lane 2. That's some of the stuff I would have been teaching at that seminar that you and I met at a couple of years ago.
I remember that very clearly. Yeah. I tell you, I sat through 2 sessions of that because I was like, yeah, this is, you know, I was in a past position and I was like, and I wasn't, you know, in a role where I mean, I was in a good role at that point, but I was like, yeah, this guy, he gets it, you know, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because what, and this is just practical economics, and this is just sort of thinking about ROI and the way that we design fundraising. You know, lane one fundraising is designed oftentimes to acquire that first gift, but it's not necessarily ever expected to create an extraordinary margin, if a margin at all. And so you're better off, and you're not creating those meaningful conversations. You're just igniting that relationship at its very elemental, sort of fundamental sort of point. And so if we allow our friends in direct response, for example, to assume that responsibility, and we as fundraisers stop getting our professional identity sort of wrapped up in all those things that play out in lane one, then we can actually enjoy the work in lane two. But that's, you know, and I've talked about this a lot too. I feel like I'm sort of rehashing my book, the argument I made in that book, but I drew that line between, you know, the initial gift and the subsequent gift. I think if we think back to your original point here, Alex, the more we as fundraisers can kind of make sense of the fact that the more you're focused on securing the donor's subsequent gift, anything other than the first gift, the more opportunity you're going to have to thrive, the more meaningful the work's going to be, the more likely you're going to, the more likely you're going to meet the expectations of your employers. But if your employers don't know how to make that distinction, and all they're saying is bring in new donors and new dollars, you're almost guaranteed to be set up to fail. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I reread or at least skimmed your book again over the past couple of days, and I found you did spend a little bit of time talking about, you know, again, I think the employer, and I say this as like employers to some degree, you know. The Chronicle can write this story every year, but employers have to start to, at some point, they're going to listen, right? I mean, they got to start, because I started my career in a smaller organization, so I didn't start in like a university or a healthcare setting. So I started in kind of the thing where I just kept asking for more responsibility, just to learn a bunch of stuff that I was interested in. It's challenging because I see the smaller orgs around here and they do, you know, fantastic work. But when I talk with EDs or, you know, folks I know there, it's the major gifts is always, they're like, oh yeah, we really want to start a gift planning program. We really want to start a major gifts program. But every time when, you know, they seem to have, you know, some trouble finding and retaining talent, but you know, the folks that want to stay on, they were brought on, say, to do major gift fund, or at least try to develop some relationships with donors. But invariably, you know, a board member gets involved or something gets involved, and they invariably get pulled back into a golf tournament, or some kind of a special event. It's tough to thrive. I guess it's tough to thrive in that environment. And I guess maybe it's tough, you know, even if you're the ED or something, to be courageous and say, look, this is a slow process. Instead of in the interview going back to the same things about, oh, we need somebody to write the newsletter. You know, we raised $100,000 at the golf tournament last year. This year, we're going to raise $150,000, which is not backed up in reality. You have to have the courage to kind of stand up and say, look, this is a slow process. This is 2 to 3 years here. But the person we need to be out there doing the work is not just somebody who's out hitting up networking events and things like that, which is what I think, you know, that's a misnomer on fundraising, too, where you think, oh, well, where those hiring think that the person who's the most connected in the community, you know, is going to be your secret weapon. Cause what folks are looking for is predictability, but you don't get that out of, you know, you need to be patient to kind of get those things going, but that'll be rewarding, you know, 10 times, 50 times in the future.
Alex, I told you before we hit the record button that you would probably say something insightful and you wouldn't even know it. I want to zero in on the question you're raising, which isn't really the question you came with, but it's this idea, because you're zeroing in on this article that the Chronicle of Philanthropy very notoriously publishes at least every couple of years, if not annually, in some sort of and it's kind of the suggestion or the implied idea that employers, I don't think employers are necessarily reading those articles. And does the Chronicle sort of know, and is there some sort of a, it's not the employers that are reading that article. It's the fundraisers that are reading that. And is that conversation even necessarily helpful? Do you follow what I'm asking?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, yeah, it's like I was at a, I think it's, you know, the joke on like, you know, journalism Twitter is that the journalists kind of all talk to each other. So the Chronicle is, you know, for, you know, is by fundraisers for fundraisers. So,
yeah,
I mean, how many EDs, especially if you're stretched thin, like I have sympathy for this, having worked in like a smaller shop. If you're stretched thin, like how many your ED or your board members, like how many of them are going to sit down on the weekend and be like, yeah, it's about time I pick up the Chronicle and really zero in.
Yeah, they're not reading that article. And so in some way, because I remember in 2019, the last time I think there's probably been a time since then. And we're speaking of the edition that came out, the one that came out just today, I think. But in 2019, there was an article that has been repeatedly sort of referenced. It's the fed up, right? Fundraisers are fed up with their jobs and half of them.
I remember it.
Yeah, and I was quoted in that. Myself and Jennifer Harris and a couple others were quoted.
Yeah,
in that.
Yeah,
yeah. And I'm just sort of thinking, is that even helpful, or is that sort of spinning a narrative that's just, you know, is the outcome of that conversation that gets stirred up every 12 to 18 months even sort of moving the needle on sort of changing that? Or do we need some kind of a, you know, is it the wrong story, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I guess that's where one thing, maybe I don't know if I have a solution except for, I think, yeah, you're right. Maybe fundraisers are kind of, we spend a lot of time talking to each other about this sort of situation. You know, my goal, again, I think I post occasionally on LinkedIn. My goal is like for just, again, just for one person to maybe see and just think, I want, you know, people to think just a little bit differently, you know, about, you know, how they're trying to get talent and how they're retaining it, honestly. It's a challenging situation.
The two different tools that I introduced at that particular training when we were in the Lehigh Valley together, one of them, I started with those two loops, those two cultural loops. And I think a lot of us in the fundraising space sort of exist in what I call this intervening subculture. And we sort of have this miserable lot that we've all sort of assumed responsibility for, and our circumstances very rarely ever seem to get better. And we never insist upon this more, what I would argue to be, needs to be more of an integrated role. I think fundraisers, even to your original point, the idea that we're signing on for jobs, you know, where we're being, like what I said, we're being signing on for jobs where we're being set up to fail. One of those fundamental ways to sort of figure that out is whether or not we're fully integrated into the culture. If you're just this, you know, subculture that exists on the periphery of the organization, you're going to be in a miserable state, and your donors are not going to experience they're not going to get much better of an experience. And I think in some ways, to get back to what I don't think was your question, but it seems like a very insightful one. I almost wonder if that article in the Chronicle almost perpetuates that. Does that make sense?
I think, yeah, I think it's interesting because the Chronicle article brings up the fact that fundraising, that's a key complaint of fundraisers, is not being integrated. Now that's interesting to me because I started in, you know, a smaller human service organization at, you know, not right out of college, but essentially, and there was always, you know, maybe you can relate to, you know, clients you've worked with. There was always a push and pull between, in that case, when I worked there, it was program and development. So,
I mean,
trying to get program to understand, you know, what we do and failing, frankly.
Yeah. Here's the question, Alex. Would the Chronicle of Philanthropy be more honest by just publishing an article every 6 to 12 months or 18 months that just says the job of a fundraiser sucks and there's nothing you can do about it? You know, if they were more forthright about that, would we actually sort of own up to that, figure that out? Why is that? Is it perhaps the existing systems, the practices, the status quo, and perhaps stop sort of coming up with all these other explanations? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, I think the challenge is they obviously were working with survey data. I'm not saying, you know, granted, I don't know if I'm going to be applying or being, you know, received for a job at the Chronicle anytime soon after our conversation here.
I'm not either.
I mean, no, and it's just, it's fun. It's not funny because, like, you read some really, some very tough stories. And I recognize people like that from those, you know, I've worked with in my community who are just, who are stretched extraordinarily thin. And yeah, I think you're right. I don't know what it is to wake people up, but yeah, we have a tendency to kind of talk to ourselves, and we have a tough time as fundraisers, especially in smaller organizations, kind of advocating on behalf of ourselves for the work we do. And yeah, it's deeply challenging, I think, in the sense that, you know, especially when I was in a smaller shop, more maybe what you, or even when I got to a larger situation where I started on a team that had 15, and by the time I left, it had 8. And, you know, the folks in that organization, you know, the top brass in that organization, they were, by the time I left, they were less invested in Major Gifts because it wasn't predictable. So even in a bigger organization where you at one time had a pretty robust development staff, there's still this tendency to fall back into the lane one situation and this is nothing against grants or anything like that, but grants are, you know, a little more predictable. You write something, there's a submission date, you can expect an outcome in one form or another.
I had a recent guest that said, you know, that one of the things that we're constantly sort of looking for in our world today is both safety and security. Safety and certainty. And he pointed out, he said, you're not going to get, you can get safety. We can create safety, but we can't create certainty. You can actually create jobs. You can write job descriptions. You can actually create working environments that are safe to work in. But the problem is, as my guest was talking about, John Alexander is the gentleman I'm talking about. What John was saying is that we're sort of, and I'm sort of reflecting on your use of the word predictability and a couple of times here. We're betting more on the idea that we can somehow or another achieve predictability, that we can build certainty into how these things sort of work. And that's my critique on lane one, that lane one is designed to sort of feed those desires for predictability, efficiency, predictability, and control. I mean, is the answer to your question that you started this conversation with, Alex, that part of growing up and signing on for jobs that we're in which we can thrive is really about the idea of finding places where we can be safe, but also not where we can be, where we're going to be naive about what is actually predictable.
That's a great point. I think that's why I think when you talk about predictability and stuff, that the reference is back to, you know, what Barbara was writing in Consume too, that, you know, predictability is like, that's, you know, another,
yes,
that's a young versus embracing unpredictability is part of, you know, a part of growing up. And, you know, the inability to sort of, yeah, to sort of, for, you know, our field and to some degree to grow into that is a major challenge. I think what I like to write about is to tell folks, if they're looking to, you know, get into the field, like, you do have to, you know, you have to be on the lookout for, you know, a hiring manager. What does the interview sound like, and what do they want you to do? If they talk sort of tangentially, oh yeah, we're really interested in doing Major Gifts, we have a couple board members who are interested in that, but they keep sort of sliding back into, you know, lane one sort of language. You know, are you going to achieve what you want to? You know, is somebody trust based when they're talking with you? Do they trust that it's okay if you're not at your desk all the time because you're out seeing donors? I've worked in an environment where, you know, if you weren't at your desk, there was questions, you know, why aren't you at your desk at 9 o'clock? Those sorts of, you know, and that, again, those are, again, I think until folks start to grow up a little bit and embrace the uncertainty, embrace the fact that it takes time to build, you know, build a real culture, you're going to be dealing with a lot of the same issues in terms of folks come and, you know, a year later they're gone. Obviously the Chronicle talked about some things that are moving in a positive direction perhaps, but again, I don't want to call them necessary, you know, getting paid more, obviously that's important. Remote work, those are important things, but I mean, I'd be curious for your feedback on that too. Are those key issues, or is there, I think, you know, I'm trying to think of what author said it. It might have been, I'm drawing a blank here, but posing, you know, well-known author, who talked a lot about, you know, what truly makes you happy in the job. You know, A is, you know, beyond your manager is autonomy.
Yes, right.
Do you have autonomy in your role where there's trust for you to do the work? And does, you know, if your smaller shop is your executive director and your board have your back, and are they willing to take the chance? So I'd be curious what you think even about, like, in terms of remote work and you know, making more money. Those are key important things. But I mean, what's really the most important thing that's going to keep people around and keep them happy in their jobs and happy as fundraisers?
Yeah, I mean, what we're advocating for, I mean, you know our three lanes well enough to understand where we sort of stand on a lot of this sort of stuff. That lane one can be very automated, it can be outsourced, and it can be driven by volunteers. So I think fundraisers need to consistently get their hands off of that sort of stuff, you know, full-time employed fundraisers, and they need to be very careful about looking at job descriptions that are overly invested in that lane one stuff. And then I think the answer to your question about remote work and even when we come to conversations about like predictability, that's the reason why we call that middle lane the messy middle lane, because the messy middle we're implying that it's very complex, it's unpredictable, it's not going to feel as efficient. It's focused on a much narrower slice of your donor population. But what you're also doing, and this gets back to Barbara's work, is you're transitioning between what I said. I would say that you're transitioning between lane one and lane two. You're transitioning the relationship with the donor from that of a consumer to more something more like a mature citizen. You're actually engaging the donor in a relationship where your expectations of the donor can be much higher. And so I don't really give a damn how the fundraising actually happens. I don't care how you're doing lane two fundraising. I'm not somebody who gets all hung up on the methods, but if you're not actually maturing that relationship and that relationship isn't yielding the opportunity for you on the fundraising side to have higher expectations of your donors, which is the point that Barber's making in his book, you're stewarding these childlike relationships with your donors and ultimately not enabling, you know, you're not allowing yourself to deliver on your mission. You're not going to get enough money from those. It's like dancing around in Munchkin Land in the Wizard of Oz.
That's exactly right. But again, I think, what's heartening to me more is, you know, especially, you know, when I came to work for the Salvation Army, I think you can tell now, and you know, I'll shamelessly plug, you know, not just the ministry itself, but, you know, I'll use this as an example of something that really impressed me, you know, when I started. And, you know, the interview process wasn't ridiculous. It wasn't like, you know, 18, you know, as I've interviewed in higher ed before, and it was terrifying the number of people they could try to squeeze into like 1 or 2 days and then tell you still had to maybe come back for another round to visit with other people. In this case, it was short and sweet. But, you know, what I liked is, you know, you could tell from, you know, conversation with, you know, with my boss that, you know, I was talking about the work I was doing in a previous job, how I was kind of straddling corporate relations and events to some degree, and also major gift fundraising in one aspect. And she's like, well, that's not really how this role operates. Like, we expect that you're going to work very hard with the portfolio that you're going to inherit. And I was like, great, that's exactly what I'm looking for. One thing the Salvation Army offers that's interesting, I think, is, you know, we have somebody who actually works at like kind of a higher level at our territorial level, that is an associate director of major gifts, and their goal is to just make you better at your job. So anytime you need to troubleshoot something that's going on with a donor, you run into a giving question, you're not quite sure how to answer and you need to get back to him. There's a legitimate person who works as a resource to help you through those challenging conversations. So it's not just a supervisor who's dealing also with, you know, internal politics, financial reporting, those sorts of the really fun part of fundraising, where you have to report out, you know, what you're actually raising and manage upward to some degree. The fact that they actually have sort of a counselor, you know, on staff to help people all throughout, say, the Eastern Territory in the Salvation Army, I think that's again, it's not replicable in a lot of shops, but I think it's something that, you know, that one ought to think about when you're sitting down to interview or to talk, you know, to talk with your hiring manager about a job. What would these folks like to do to make me successful? Are they going to let me work autonomously? Those are kind of two key things I look for in any role.
Alex, I think there's a lot of organizations that quite frankly are just scared of fundraising. And so they approach, and it's not that they're scared specific, you know, they would probably never articulate it that way, but I don't know that they own up to the fact that they're scared of fundraising any more than they're scared of money, that they're scared of wealth, that they're scared of major donors, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in some ways, some of what you're sort of picking up on here about the interview process is you might be able to you might be able to sort of discern, you might be able to pick up on some of that risk aversion, I guess you could say, some of that hesitancy that comes with everything that the fundraiser represents. So if they're interviewing you in such a way that suggests that, you know, they're just trying to eliminate all the possible negative outcomes that could possibly come with forming this relationship, my guess is, Alex, they're going to approach the relationships with their donors the same way. You can really I think what you're saying to us this afternoon is that you can really overthink and you can really overcomplicate the interview process. My thought is that same employer is inclined to overthink and overcomplicate the donor relationship process the same way. Does that make sense?
Oh, you know, yeah, that's a great point, actually, because the funny thing is not for everybody. What first got me like irritated at some point where I started actually write a little bit on LinkedIn is I saw one of those like real snoozer, you know, sort of articles, the 10 best qualities of a fundraiser. And I'm like,
sure. Right.
So where I'm going with this is, you know, one quality is that, oh, well, you know, I can't understand how introverts do this job because, you know, it must be exhausting. Like, again, just, you know, extroverts are the only, you know, folks qualified to do this. And this is, again, what is the interview process? What are they looking for? It's all, you know, in a lot of cases, somebody who's extroverted, somebody who can work a room. I'd say I'm more an introvert or at least somewhere in between. So I find that personally, like, yeah, folks don't get me. They, again, making the whole process again, yeah, too much too complicated. And when you actually start to go out there and work with donors, as I have in this new role, being an introvert has worked, you know, incredibly well for me because you spend a lot of time listening. And frankly, I think my initial point was, I don't know exactly if there's a right or wrong personality type for the role, but, you know, I love the work and I don't find that position all that challenging. And I think if more, you know, smaller shops realize it's not that challenging, if we hire the right person who's an excellent listener, who's dedicated, you know, at their core to the mission. You know, I frankly, when I was playing golf tournaments, I was miserable. I hated it. It was far more challenging for far less reward and return. This is like the message I want to like reach to people is like, to start relationships, it's a little challenging. It's tough to pick up the phone to ask for that first visit. It's tough, man. I'm not saying it's not. But at the same time, when you're working with people who are committed to the donors that are committed to your mission, I mean, it's really a pleasure. It's a joy. And I've never found that. And you run into challenges, of course, you know, and challenging questions, but that doesn't take away from the fact that I think it's a far, you know, easier, it's far easier and more lucrative than playing a golf tournament. So I feel bad for, you know, slagging on golf tournaments here so much, but
yeah, I can't affirm your opinion or your observation about the sort of the introvert versus extrovert sort of question as it relates to fundraising. I can tell you that I tend to, on the Myers-Briggs, for example, score relatively extroverted. But I can tell you that I've watched many individuals that are far more introverted raise far more money, be far better listeners. You know, guys like me can't keep their mouth shut. We don't know how to shut up. I mean, we've actually worked with clients where they, just like myself, have to be told, look, you've got to shut up at some point and stop talking and let the donor actually have a, you know, put a word in, get a word in edgewise. Because, you know, someone like yourself knows how to sit across the lunch table, have a conversation with Mr. and Mrs. Smith or whoever you're meeting with, and actually listen and therefore craft that proposal in a way that aligns with what your organization's needs are, mixed with what their expectations are, you know, what they're inclined to give to. And oftentimes someone like myself, who's, you know, gregarious and friendly and always got something to say, oftentimes misses that sort of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely understand. I've worked for plenty of extroverts, and, you know, I think I'm more, again, maybe this isn't even the direction I started in at the beginning, but for some reason I was like, when I talk with Jason, I want to get that introvert extrovert piece in there a little bit, because I think it's a hindrance. I think the idea that only extroverts, you know, really are positive at this sort of work. I mean, there's incredible, obviously yourself included, incredibly, you know, talented fundraisers who are, you know, outgoing and gregarious. You know, I also say to, you know, employers that are looking there, like, you know, the Chronicle again in their article saying, oh, we're looking at people with some different backgrounds. Usually to get a job in higher ed fundraising, you had to also, before, you had to be raising money but not just anywhere, in higher ed fundraising. You know, at a liberal arts college, it was probably at a liberal arts school. So again, think outside the box, not just in terms of, you know, background, but also personality type, I think.
I mean, my advice, and this lines up very much with our argument between the three lanes, is that you get as young as you possibly could be in your fundraising career. I'm speaking of tenure in the work, not age necessarily, but, you know, get in front of the donor. My argument is get in front of the donor as early as possible, which is, you know, lane two is directly interacting with the donor on a routine basis. And I think fundraisers need to be increasingly discerning about whether or not that's what the job description says. Those jobs that keep you very distanced from the donor, that's all necessary work. That's all important work, but does it necessarily need to be done by a person on the payroll? And can it not be done more efficiently by, you know, like I said, you know, we've got plenty of friends who are in direct response who can do that for you. I'm sure the Salvation Army is an example. You guys have direct response companies that help you guys sort of pull that sort of stuff off.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so the insight there is to recognize that your direct response partner, for example, is far more knowledgeable, has far greater scale, and can do that with 10 or 12 other organizations while they're doing that with the Salvation Army. And then what that allows you to do is sort of free yourself up from having to have that expertise, and allows you to double down on investing in the expertise that makes you shine at that lunch table. That's essentially the message that you got at that event that we were at a couple of years ago, was draw a line between lanes one and two and bet your job, you know, bet your professional career on lane two is what people are generally hearing from me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, I read some of the dialogue you were involved in when you talked about, you know, tools and somebody who was an event specialist who was really good at that. Well, during the pandemic, what good is being, you know, the tool itself is not going to allow you to mature and grow with the donors, you know, unfortunately. I mean, it's just a reality. It's going to be those folks, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of my own job, which I really like, but you're going to get the most satisfaction, and you know, the work for the Salvation Army. I mean, it was those folks that are lane two, or perhaps even lane three, that are the ones that are coming to you. Then they're coming to the table. They know they have a mature relationship with the Salvation Army. They say, "Hey, man, it's getting crazy out there. How can we help you out?" I mean, that's the conversation you want to be having, where you know the donors well enough, they know the organization well enough to come and say, "We want to help you," without me having to call and schedule even a lunch. So.
Alex, we lose our listeners about 45 minutes in, so we're right at about that point. Before I let you go, I do want to ask you if somebody's got a. Usually, people who are my guests hear from our listeners more often than I do. Somebody's going to follow up with you and say, "Hey, I want to keep that conversation going. I've got a thought on something you said." How would you like people to reach out to you, and how do they find you?
Oh yeah, well, I've noticed, Jason, that you have a lot of folks who've like written books and run their own consulting firms that have some. I'm a lowly major gift officer. Easiest way to find me is on, my name's Alex Dabkowitz. You can find me on LinkedIn. That's pretty much the only social media that I exist on any longer. So that's where anybody can find me if they should be interested in hearing how they could hire and retain fundraisers, right?
Yeah. It's been a great conversation, Alex. It has certainly been a pleasure. I look forward to being in the room with you very soon. In the meantime, you're always welcome back.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Been a pleasure being here. Appreciate it.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.